Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.
Hi there, it's Anita Johnson, and just a quick request before we get started. Please rate us on iTunes or wherever you catch our podcast. That helps other people to find us. And of course, give us a high rating. Thanks, and here's the show.
Making contact.
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Salima Hamarani. And today we're airing part two of a special investigative series from our friends at San Francisco Public Press. The investigation is called Exposed, the Human Radiation Experiments at Hunters Point, where they track the ongoing toxic waste at the Naval Shipyard in Bayview Hunters Point in San Francisco and trace it back to the atomic experiments conducted near the Marshall Islands. In part two of today's story, we take a look at the disturbing history of human radiological experiments by the Navy, which were often performed without consent. And we look at how that legacy still affects Bayview Hunters Point today. Here's San Francisco Public Press reporter Rebecca Bao.
At the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard, where a massive real estate development project is under construction, there's a windowless, white concrete building. It once housed the Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory. During the Cold War, scientists from this lab participated in nuclear tests and conducted experiments that exposed humans to radiation.
In the military, they tell you what to do, and you do it. And if you don't do it, you have big problems. You better do it, or you're going to go to the stockade. Period. That's it.
In 1956, Aldridge Jones served in the military. He was based at Fort Ord, not far from Monterey. But that summer, he was sent to the San Francisco Bay Area to help with a research study that exposed him to radioactive material. Decades later, Jones, who was then 84, shared his story.
God, if I'd have known then what I know now, and I had the opportunity, I would never have gone.
Our journey to connect with Aldridge Jones started in the National Archives, where my project collaborators and I found the first initials and last names of participants in government radiation studies. We eventually found Jones through a veterans association. The military experiment was called Operation Stoneman.
There was a group of us in the 50th Chemical Platoon that were sent to Camp Stoneman.
Camp Stoneman was a military base located in modern-day Pittsburgh. When Jones and his comrades arrived, it had been abandoned for some time. During World War II, soldiers bound for combat in the Pacific had trained there.
When we got there, they took us through various things. And then there was a truck that came in, and it was full of radiated material. They told us that we had to take that radiated material and put it on the roofs of at least, it was two or three buildings, I think it was. I was involved in putting it on one building.
Next, he says, he and other troops used Geiger counters to find out how much gamma radiation the dirt was emitting.
And what we did, when we got it up there, we took readings of what the dosage was up there. Then we washed off the roofs of the buildings, and then we took readings of the radiation that was left on the roof again, and I don't remember the readings there. But all that mud was washed into the gutters.
They had to repeat the process over and over again for a week. Other soldiers who participated were made to rub radioactive dirt on their bare arms and hands. They were scanned for radiation, then they washed off, then they were scanned again. Scientists running the operation called the substance the soldiers coated themselves with synthetic fallout, but it gave off real gamma radiation. It contained a radioactive isotope of an artificial element called lanthanum-140. Although technical reports we found described the study participants as volunteers, Jones said he had no choice in the matter.
We had no idea who was involved. We were just told what to do, and we did it.
As it turned out, the experiment was a partnership between the Army and the Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory. That's the military research lab that operated at the Hunters Point shipyard at the height of the Cold War. The lab was particularly focused on what was known at the time as decontamination, so methods for clearing away nuclear fallout. Of course, scientists today understand that radioactive material can persist for hundreds or even thousands of years. That's why the Navy is still working today to clean up radioactive waste at the Hunters Point shipyard. This wasn't the first exposure for Jones. In 1955, he was deployed to the Nevada test site, about an hour north of Las Vegas.
And it was just, we were taken there to show what the atomic bomb looked like when it went off. We were given glasses that would withstand the light of the blast. It was like, if you were in the daylight, you put those glasses on, you couldn't see. You couldn't see 10 feet or so at all. But with the glasses on and the nuclear bomb went off, you could certainly see the bomb really bright.
The Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory back in San Francisco also played a role in those nuclear detonation tests. Its scientists collected reams of data.
I was within 1 mile of ground zero three times when the blast went off. We were in a revetment, which is below the ground level. And literally, you could, when the blast goes off, it's just like if you close your eyes and open them, and the blast goes off, then you put your hands over your eyes like this. You can see the bones of your hand and look right through your hands and see the vehicle that's beside you bouncing around. That's how bright they are.
All told, Jones witnessed 14 nuclear bomb explosions in the desert. Today he suffers from blindness and blood flow issues that his doctors have suggested might be related to his radiation exposure. You can hear the way the military talked about these tests from this clip from the 1950s, where a general describes a bomb blast that his troops had just witnessed.
General Hodge, what would you say was the main reaction of the troops there in the trenches as they were waiting for the bomb to go off?
Well, the reaction of the troops in the trenches, they did exactly what they were told to do. They showed good discipline, which was good sense in this case. Any man stuck his head up, there was trouble in store for him.
And they seemed to take all the discipline very well.
They did indeed.
When Jones was made to spread radioactive dirt onto rooftops, he'd been sent in wearing nothing more protective than his normal summer fatigues. He was part of the first group sent to Camp Stoneman for the lab's research. In 1958, a second group of soldiers was dispatched there.
They said it was going to be a decontamination, and that was about what they told us. I don't remember them saying anything else
Until
we got there.
That's Merle Votaw, a Navy veteran who participated in Operation Stoneman 2. This time, researchers wanted to simulate what would happen if combat troops were fighting in a nuclear battlefield. They studied how much radiation the soldiers' clothing and their bodies would absorb. Each time they geared up, they had to crawl through several hundred feet of radioactive soil. It also used lanthanum 140, synthetic fallout. Votaw told my project collaborator Chris Roberts that he was exposed to asbestos in addition to radiation throughout his time in the service. Nearly 80 years old at the time of the interview, he was quick to note that he had emerged unscathed. In the tape, you'll hear Chris asking questions.
So they told you that you would be taking some radiation, but not a lot. Like, did that worry you? Like, or were you just kind of like, okay, okay, yeah.
It didn't worry me. I think it worried them more than it did me.
But do you know the Army had to crawl through it, and they cut out their clothes, and those samples was all sent to Harris Point. But we never heard anything about it, you know, what happened or anything. But
In modern times, nuclear power plant workers aren't supposed to receive more than 5 rads of radiation per year. But one Stoneman 2 study participant received an estimated 280 rads of beta radiation all at once. According to the Operation Stoneman report, a mixer truck was used to blend the synthetic fallout. The truck's spray nozzle malfunctioned, and a lab machinist named Nicholas DeLambeau took the nozzle apart to see what was wrong. He promptly sprayed the radioactive substance directly onto his hand. Attempts to wash it off with soap and water weren't effective. It stuck to his skin. We tried but failed to track down DeLambeau or his next of kin, so we'll never know for certain what happened to him after that day.
We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. Today's piece is the second part of a two-part investigative series from San Francisco Public Press called Exposed: The Human Radiation Experiments at Hunter's Point. If you missed part one, you can visit our website, focmedia.org, where we also have links for the show, including the full written investigation on the San Francisco Public Press website. And now, back to the show.
Over the last couple years, Chris and I made several trips to the research room at the National Archives branch in San Bruno, where declassified government records are stored. Declassified memos from 1947 show that the radiation lab was established together with the Atomic Energy Commission, a civilian department that succeeded the Manhattan Project. The lab had several distinct purposes. It looked into methods for decontamination. It was supposed to figure out ways to dispose of radioactive waste. It studied atomic bomb detonations, and it conducted experiments to evaluate how much radiation it was safe for humans to absorb. We found evidence suggesting several hundred people were exposed to radiation over 2 decades of the lab's operation. In 1955, a man named Albert Behnke, the radiological medical director at the Hunter's Point Lab, arranged a study using football players from the San Francisco 49ers as test subjects. He was an expert in determining body composition, essentially figuring out how much fat, bone mass, nutrients, and other components are in a person. The hope was that research on body composition would help doctors diagnose and treat diseases. To do this, researchers would inject people with trace amounts of radioactive isotopes of elements naturally found in the human body. Behnke was especially interested in athletes, so he saw a great scientific opportunity when he got the chance to try this on the 49ers. It's an example of what's known as a tracer study, which at the time were happening all over the country.
Tracer studies would be really minimal amounts of radioisotopes that were relatively harmless, that weren't going to damage, say, the thyroid or another organ of the body that would be excreted harmlessly.
That's journalist Eileen Welsom. She authored The Plutonium Files, a book about human radiation experiments. In her book, she notes that institutions that carried out human radiation experiments often defended tracer studies as harmless. But she's skeptical of that conclusion.
We don't know whether they were harmless or not, because we don't know who the patients were in all those studies. I think there's some records showing where they were done, but it would be very hard to find those records now and be able to find out who the patients were, where they lived, and what happened to them.
She says a key problem was that even if doctors didn't think these substances would really harm the test subjects, many of them were given doses of radiation without informed consent.
The right thing to have done was to say, this is radioactive iodine. It's not going to hurt you. Would you mind if we gave it to you? So if you are about to put a foreign substance in a person's body, the least you can do is ask.
In 1993, Wellesen published an investigative series for the Albuquerque Tribune that turned up something much more sinister. It all started when she stumbled upon an intriguing detail in a government document.
I came across a footnote that described 18 people who were injected with plutonium during the Manhattan Project. So I was really shocked. So that began my research, and I spent the next 6 years trying to find these 18 people. But long story short, once this series came out, it created a furor. I mean, it was incredible. I called it the big story that nearly wiped out the little paper.
Her newsroom was inundated with calls, some from as far away as Japan. Wellesen's series had uncovered a chapter of history previously swept under the rug. Her work showed that scientists who had participated in the Manhattan Project, a vast government effort to build the atomic bomb, had also conducted a secret program of intentionally exposing people to radiation. This happened even though some within their ranks argued against experimenting on humans. Some even compared what was being done to experimentation carried out by the Nazis. But the studies went ahead, fueled by an obsession with preparing for nuclear warfare. And there was plenty of money to fund it. The Atomic Energy Commission shelled out the cash.
All the armed forces, of course, got into the act. I mean, there was like millions of dollars available, largely from the federal government, to fund this research. So it was just an explosion of research all over the country, everywhere.
Her work told the stories of people who were exposed to radiation and later developed crippling diseases. She won a Pulitzer Prize. Her work prompted the federal government to launch an investigation. President Bill Clinton convened an advisory committee on human radiation experiments. The commission would compile declassified public records and investigate what had transpired. On October 3rd, 1995, the task force released the findings and Clinton made a public statement.
While most of the tests were ethical by any standards, some were unethical, not only by today's standards, but by the standards of the time in which they were conducted. They failed both the test of our national values and the test of humanity.
In another tracer study from 1949, a UC Berkeley researcher exposed inmates at San Quentin Prison to small amounts of radioactive iron. The prisoners were labeled as volunteers.
The report also demonstrates that these and other experiments were carried out on precisely those citizens who count most on the government for its help, the destitute and the gravely ill. But the dispossessed were not alone. Members of the military, precisely those on whom we and our government count most, they were also test subjects. Informed consent means your doctor tells you the risk of the treatment you are about to undergo. In too many cases, informed consent was withheld.
You might think the president discussing revelations of secret military research carried out on vulnerable populations would be big news. Not exactly. By coincidence, the report came out on the same day as the O.J. Simpson murder trial verdict.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section.
So it barely made a blip in the news cycle. Few people remember this, much less connected to San Francisco or its shipyard. Even today, as Bay Area news outlets report on the decades-long environmental cleanup at the Hunters Point shipyard, the lab's role in human experiments almost never comes up. And throughout our research, my project collaborator Chris Roberts and I ran up against another obstacle, government secrecy. Here's his take.
I mean, according to the National Archives, maybe as little as 1% or 2% of the voluminous paper record produced by the shipyard's radiation lab exists today. We know that records were shredded, and we know some might have just been lost.
Some records that were declassified were apparently reclassified under the Trump administration. One fall day in 2019, we went to the National Archives to look through boxes that had been pulled at our request, only to find that most of them were full of air. Instead of radiation lab records, we found notices inside saying that the information had been withdrawn over the past year and was now reclassified and physically relocated to a more secure government facility. Dial it back to 1995, and it's almost as if members of the Clinton Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments saw this coming. Here's Dr. Ruth Vaden, who directed the investigation, addressing members of her committee.
You have opened the doors of this nation's records, and they must stay open. Information must not be concealed again from people in their own time, so that it takes two generations for the truth to come out.
Among the records that did survive from the era are accounts of research the San Francisco lab conducted far away in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. The U.S. military had been conducting atomic tests here for years. This time, lab scientists were brought in to study how radiation affected islanders. On March 1st, 1954, the military detonated a bomb there with 1,000 times the energy of the one that destroyed Hiroshima, in a test called Castle Bravo. This thermonuclear explosion was the largest nuclear test in U.S. history. Historic archives of Operation Bravo still exist, showing footage of the explosion while a commander reports on measurements taken to determine the size of the blast.
This photograph was taken from an airplane at 50 miles. The width of the fireball at this time, about 3 seconds after detonation, was 4 miles. The top of the fireball at this time, 40 seconds after detonation, was 5 miles above sea level. Prove that we can have a high-yield weapon weighing less than 10 tons.
Castle Bravo was nearly 3 times as powerful as its architects predicted. So Marshallese people living on Rongelap Atoll and nearby islands were exposed to extremely dangerous levels of nuclear fallout. The Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory was involved here, too. Scientists were sent in after the blasts to study Marshallese people who had received high doses of radiation from that event.
There's very little discussion of these human radiation experiments. It's something that's still not really talked about in the Marshall Islands. It's something the U.S. government never talks about. It's a conversation that very rarely happens at all in public.
That's anthropologist Holly Barker, a professor at the University of Washington, who conducted extensive research in the Marshall Islands. This is her delivering a lecture in Seattle in 2012. As she points out, the Marshallese people who were caught in a blizzard of radioactive fallout were not evacuated prior to the Castle Bravo bomb explosion. In the years that followed, people suffered severe health consequences. They developed cancer, battled thyroid problems, and gave birth to infants suffering from critical birth defects, whose lives lasted less than a day. Yet during and after the immense explosion, medical researchers couldn't resist the opportunity for data collection.
Following the detonation of one of the largest nuclear tests ever conducted in the world, in fact, the largest test ever conducted by the U.S., the Bravo test that was tested on March 1st, 1954, after a community, two communities, Rongelap and Utrecht, were exposed to radiation from the testing, the U.S. government took the people who were exposed and brought them to Kwajalein Atoll and created a military encampment made out of barbed wire where they put the Marshallese who had been exposed to the radiation inside the encampment and enrolled them without their permission into a top secret medical experimentation program called Project 4.1. And Project 4.1 was to test the effects of radiation on human beings. Some of these tests included injecting radiation directly into the bloodstream of Marshallese so that the U.S. could then study the difference if you expose somebody to radiation from fallout from a weapon or if the blood or if the radiation goes into their bloodstream. Other human radiation experiments included having Marshallese drink radioactive substances directly, again, so they could compare what would happen if it went into the body via the mouth, and they could compare that to the radioactive fallout. The U.S. government took a control population that was not from Rongelap or Utrecht and had never been exposed to radiation from the testing program, and also had them injected with radiation or had them drink the radiation so they could compare them to the other group. And so they set up this medical experimentation.
Dr. James Robertson, who was assigned to the Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory in 1953, went to Rongelap to track Marshallese people's exposure. He used an instrument called a whole body counter, a lead-lined room weighing about 30 tons. A 1995 interview he gave encapsulates the dehumanizing attitude researchers associated with this lab held toward islanders who suffered severe health effects from nuclear fallout. Marshallese people who were studied for these tests were made to spend up to half an hour inside the whole body counter. Robertson's interview explains that his team used the machine to measure radiation islanders had absorbed by eating contaminated food. He said that while Marshallese test subjects walked into the lead-lined room and waited for the screening process to be over, researchers played this song to keep the time and to entertain them. He told the interviewer that he grew tired of hearing the same song over and over again.
And then she placed them in a bower.
Back in San Francisco, some of the same radioactive material that was transported from nuclear bomb tests in the Marshall Islands persists today in the soil at the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. A major development project is underway there, but it's mired in a toxic cleanup scandal. The effort to clean up the soil has cost more than $1 billion, prompting multiple lawsuits. Many of the shipyard workers and study volunteers who were exposed to radiation during the 1950s and 60s are reaching the end of their lives today, and the history is fading with them. But a new generation hasn't forgotten, and the mess left behind by the U.S. Navy has yet to be fully cleaned up. At this abandoned naval base, once a hub of nuclear research that routinely jeopardized human health on behalf of a military superpower, the future is far from certain.
That was Rebecca Bao, the special reporter for this piece at San Francisco Public Press. If you want more information about the Naval Shipyard and its cleanup, you can visit us online at focmedia.org. There, we also have links to San Francisco Public Press and their full investigation. You can listen to the first part of the series and learn more about the history of secret human radiological testing. You can also leave us a comment. We'd love to hear from you as always. And that does it for today's show. I'm Salima Hamrani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming.